Welcome back to After the Buzzer. I am Gordy Jones, and joining me on the phone line is that Mike Gross. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Gordy.
And also joining us is Mark Brennan of Lions 24/7. Listeners will know him from his coverage of Penn State football, but he is joining us partially in that capacity, but more because he's a 76ers fan, and it is a Tuesday night, and we want to rehash what we witnessed in game four of the Sixers series against Atlanta. So hello to you, Mark.
It's great to be here, Gordy and Mike, and I want everybody there to know that when I'm talking about the Sixers, I am not talking as a reporter. I'm talking as a fan. I don't want anybody to misconstrue me with being some sort of objective person. I yell at my TV just like everybody else does and cheer for them. So I am not handling that in a reporter's role. But when we talk Penn State stuff, I'll definitely revert to reporter's role.
Okay. Well, let's start there, Mark. I mean, it must be I don't know if relief is the right word or just enjoyment, maybe not enjoyment last night, but just what it's like just to watch as a fan, because you wear a lot of hats for Lions 24/7 between the writing piece and the photography piece and the video piece. So I'm guessing it's therapeutic, maybe not last night, but generally speaking, maybe.
No, it's cool. I mean, as you said, when you go and you cover, when I go and cover a game, it's a whole different thing. You know, there's no emotion unless we're yelling at each other in the press box or cracking jokes or whatever. And to be able to watch something and actually enjoy it and maybe have a beverage or two as you're doing it, you know, that part's enjoyable. And then the other cool thing for me is, you know, my daughter has, like me, because I basically forced her to do it, mm-hmm. she would have had to move out when she was young. If she didn't like all the Philadelphia teams, but you know, I got her to like all the Philadelphia teams too. My wife likes them, so my daughter and I are able to watch the Sixers games together. Wow. And we've been doing it for several years since the process, and to be able to kind of enjoy it now is pretty cool. She's in an age, you know, 19. A lot of those younger folks kind of skip around from team to team. That, you know, they're fans of players maybe more than teams. But she kind of learned that, I think it was pretty cool that when you follow a team as a fan, when they stink, and then you have the opportunity to see them when they're good, as we did with the Eagles, when the Eagles won the Super Bowl, you appreciate that Super Bowl that much more. So hopefully from a fan perspective, the Sixers can play better than they did last night and get things rolling again. But it's overall, yeah, it's definitely been fun.
I love, Mark, the image of your daughter having been kicked out of the house and like hitchhiking with a pirate's hat on or something.
When she was like 4 years old. Yeah. You must like the Phillies. You don't have a choice. You know, these people giving their kids choices, you know, when it comes to being fans of teams, you can't do that. You got to make them, you know, once they're out of the house, they can like whoever they want. But when she was in this house, she's got to like my teams.
It's interesting because I want to, this is sort of a humble brag, but actually today I got an email from a reader who is a Sixers fan who literally started the email with, "Mike, please talk me in off the ledge." I'm swearing you that happened, and which I'm sort of touched by. I made some attempt to talk. He did a long thing about Embiid and everything, and I did make it a sincere attempt to talk him in off the ledge. But anyway.
Yeah, so your response was, "So, Dave Jones, let me tell you, this is why you shouldn't be panicking about the Sixers and Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid."
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. You know, well, if they'd have made that Ben Simmons for Buddy Hield,
and we're off.
You know, it's funny because so for people who don't know, Dave Jones and I have had a back and forth from the time that Simmons and Buddy Hield were in college, and he was saying Buddy Hield would be a better player in the NBA, and I just thought he was out of his mind then. Just like I don't think he thinks that anymore. but he still gets on me constantly about Ben Simmons and how he's never going to win anything. He's conveniently left out the Buddy Hield part of the argument. So he's just, anytime Ben Simmons struggles, he dogpiles me with Ben Simmons. And just last night, I had to bring up the Buddy Hield again. Because it's like, you're forgetting that the crux of this whole argument, started with Ben Simmons versus Buddy Hield. But it's fun. And that's the part about, Dave actually will write more, not as a fan about this stuff. I mean, he actually writes about, the pro teams in Philadelphia as a professional. But it is fun that we get debate and go back and forth about that stuff.
The thing you have to bear in mind there is Dave loves shooters and hates non-shooters because the only thing he could do as a basketball player was shoot.
Yeah. Whenever the Sixers lose, it's the agony of defeat. And then the double agony of talking to Dave about the game afterward. Because it's like, he will get like an 8-pound bag of salt and rub it in those wounds you wouldn't believe and say, I told you so. But again, that's half the fun of being a fan of sports.
Well, all that said, Simmons took one shot in the second half last night when the air was coming out of the balloon. You as a Simmons guy, Mark, what say you to that?
Yeah, he can't do that. I mean, I just think overall, in general, you look overall in that game, they had 34 points in the paint in that game. Mm-hmm. And that to me, against that Hawks team, whose biggest players, I mean, I know they list those guys at 6'10", but if they're 6'9", Gallinari, I mean, you can't have 34 points in the paint. Right. And who does that start with? That starts with Simmons getting to the basket, and it starts with Embiid being more of a force in the paint. I mean, I didn't look at his points and Embiid's points in the paint number for last night. I should check it out, but I don't think it was very many. It couldn't have been more than a handful. And for him, just the team in general, you have that size advantage. Take advantage of it.
Yeah.
They just didn't do it. So I think you can point to Simmons as an example of it. And, yeah, I absolutely agree that he has to get to the basket and be more of an offensive threat. But overall, the team, and I think that's why Doc was so mad. Right. Because I think if they had just run through their offense, shots would have been there. And yeah. if you weren't going to get points in the paint, you could have gotten even more wide-open looks for Curry and for Korkmaz. But that just didn't happen. And then you look at what happened in the fourth quarter where they got, I think, one field goal from their big four in the fourth quarter.
That sounds right.
Can't happen. Wow. Yeah, I mean, it just can't happen. So those are the things where you understand Doc's level of frustration, dropping F-bombs in the post-game press conference. But that's why I have more hope, because I think Doc, I'm hoping at least that he has a level of respect from those players that Brett Brown, I'm not sure, ever had. Mm-hmm. That he can call them out after a game like that and say, hey, listen, mm-hmm. This was a golden opportunity. You guys blew it. Mm-hmm. It was right there, and you didn't take care of business. And I think he has the cachet that Brett Brown never had that, you would hope that they have enough common sense to listen to him and realize the opportunity that they missed.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I think that's right. Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I didn't see this game, guys, because I was covering – high school baseball, the state playoffs. But I looked at the box score, and it was this box score was a WTF all over.
Yeah.
The Hawks got 105 shots at the basket, or 101
or
something like that. They didn't shoot well at all. They only had four turnovers. Bogdanovich and Trae Young shot a combined 17 for 50. Mm-hmm. How did the Sixers let this get away? Mark, you just said it, a lot of it, but wow.
The big number is Joel Embiid 0 for 12 in the second half. And the other thing that's not reflected in the box score is that John Collins was much better than his stats. He had 14 and 12, but he was a physical presence, and as Mark just alluded to, when Doc Rivers said that they were outworked the whole bleeping game, John Collins was a big part of that.
Yeah, to have a guy that size having how many follow dunks?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, listen, I get that he's athletic enough that you're going to get one or two.
Yeah.
But he had, what was it, four? I mean, it was just incredible. And that, I think, got the crowd back into it.
Yeah.
And that got the team energized. And the Sixers just didn't have that energy. And it was like they were going through the motions in the second half. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I will say defensively, I thought they were fine. You know, going to Mike's point, if you hold a team under 110 points in the playoffs, that Sixers team should win every single time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that they weren't patient doing what they needed to do on offense, getting the ball into the paint, they didn't get to the free throw line. I think they shot 15 free throws as a team. Again, when you have that size advantage across the board,
mm-hmm.
and when you have horrible defenders for the Hawks, I mean, Trae Young can't guard anybody.
No.
Herder was horrendous trying to guard people, and they didn't exploit it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had matchups. They had a matchup it every time down the floor where somebody could have taken somebody if that's what they wanted to do. And then I also think Tobias came up really small late in the game. I mean, they did that as a team,
mm-hmm.
but on a night when Joel Embiid is struggling physically and Simmons clearly didn't seem like he wanted to get the ball to the rack, I'm anxious for Tobias to see if he's able to step up late in one of these games when Embiid's struggling and put the team on his shoulders. You know, it's great when in a playoff game he scored 28 in the first half of a game, but I want to see him take over in the fourth quarter of one of these games where Embiid, you know, you can see Embiid has the worst body language in the world when he's not feeling well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if you caught what he said to the fans, you know, shut the bleep up.
That's
and then he doesn't back it up as they're booing him.
Not good.
That's okay. I mean, not everybody's going to be perfect every game.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so bumped up that he's going to struggle at times. That's where I think you need a Tobias Harris to be more of a consistent threat and to say, hey, listen, Joel's not getting it done. I got to take it on my shoulders.
Sadly, Tobias sort of has a history of not showing up at this time of year. And that's kind of distressing that it's kind of reared its head again last night. I mean, because the games are obviously only going to get harder and more crucial. So I think the jury remains out on him at this time of year until he actually does it. Because it just, I've said this before. In fact, I've written this before, just that his numbers too often seem like a lot of empty calories. They really look nice, but what do they really mean? You know, that's my question about him.
Yeah, well, I think he's been good this year, though. I really do. I mean, I didn't see last night, but I in the playoffs to this point, I think he's been very good. Why he didn't do it last night, I don't know.
It was a weird game. Sure.
Yeah, I guess my point, Mike, is that he's been good. He played at an all-star level all season. But aren't we all just waiting for him in a playoff game to be the guy who does it?
Yes, absolutely.
And listen, I know that 90% of the time it's going to be Embiid, and rightfully so, because he's been big at the end of most games. And you just can't blast him terribly for yesterday's game, because he was struggling. He was out there trying to get it done. How many times is he going to miss that layup at the end of the game? I mean, one out of 90 or something, you know what I mean? He's going to make that the vast majority of times. But on the time that he does struggle, you know, that's where Jimmy Butler would have stepped it up. And there's always going to be that comparison, but that's where you need that player. And I would say that's also one area where not having Danny Green, because as up and down as he's been, as he was before getting injured, and obviously he was horrible in the first game of the series, he's a guy who's gotten it done in the clutch in playoff games for a lot of teams.
Three
and that's where not having him, and I'm not using that as an excuse for them losing. They still should have won. But those are the little things that I think you stack one on top of another on top of another, and that's why they end up losing.
Yeah.
Well, here's something I want to throw at you guys. Two things, actually. One, I thought in the second half of Game 3, the Sixers made a really nice adjustment in posting up Simmons, and that was very effective. And if you remember, they really had a great third quarter and kind of grabbed that game by the throat. And I thought that was one of the best performances they've had in this, you know, process era. That's one thing. And the other thing is, if we accept that Embiid lacks mobility and lacks explosiveness right now, would an effective adjustment be make him park his ass in the very low post?
Yes.
And with his back to the basket and throw it into him and, hey, he's score or foul me. Would that be a thing that they can finally fully commit to, given that he can't score all the other ways that he can normally score, maybe?
Yeah, they could commit to it, but he would have to commit to it. I mean, that's what it boils down to. Is he going to commit to it?
That's right.
And unless he does, that's not going to change. And here's the other thing that I think they really should consider. I wouldn't play Dwight Howard in this series. I just wouldn't. You know, unless you need to rough them up a little bit. He can't match up with anybody on that team defensively. He just can't. They don't have a prototypical center.
Yeah.
You know, he may come into play if you're playing against Lopez from Milwaukee in the next round. But they're better off if Embiid can't go. I think getting Mike Scott in there, somebody with more mobility, or playing Ben Simmons at the five. Now, I know that you can't have Ben Simmons in the game for all 48 minutes, but I would like to see more of that than seeing Dwight Howard, because I just think, you know, Dwight Howard had a whole bunch of rebounds yesterday. But offensively, if he's not dunking, he's missing layups, and he's a liability defensively, in my view.
I like that idea of Simmons at the five. That would be a super fast lineup that I think would be, no matter what the Hawks put out there, would be quicker, more versatile, more athletic. I think that's an interesting thought. And as we
and also Simmons' defensive versatility too.
Yeah.
Right, and they don't have the post presence that's going to exploit that.
No, not right. Yeah.
You know, the way that a prototypical center would be able to. I mean, obviously, you couldn't do that against Joker. I mean, you couldn't do that against a team with even somebody like the Lopez brothers. You just couldn't do that.
Right.
But with this team, you absolutely could do it.
Yeah. So it's very interesting to me. And as we've seen in this series, Doc has been willing to play hunches, you know, i.e. Shake Milton was one of them, and that paid off for him in game two. So I'll be interesting to see what he comes up with. But certainly, as you mentioned earlier, Mark, as we've seen with coaches, all of us through the years, he was coaching his team through the media last night when he said what he said about being outworked, that there was certainly, you know, okay, you're going to hear my voice from a little different angle and you know, let's see how you respond to it.
Yeah. He's so savvy. Yeah. I don't want to rip on Brown, because I think he was very important to get them through that process. I don't know many coaches that could have survived that, you know, and stayed as sharp mentally as he was. and stayed invested. I mean, seriously. But I mean, Doc is just operating at a whole different level, and that's the refreshing thing to see. And that's where your person, Mike, your reader who wrote to you saying, you know, talk me off the ledge. I think the thing that would help you get off the ledge is knowing that you have a coach like Doc Rivers, who I think has a much better feel for how to push the right buttons and get things done.
Yeah, I mean, he's been there so many times. I mean, he won a title with the Celtics. He was there, I think, twice more in the finals. I mean, he's had some bad luck in the playoffs, too. I mean, I think he's lost more 3-1 leads in the playoffs than any other coach. So
that's a resume builder right there, baby.
So there's that. But, yeah, I agree with you in substance, Mark, about him being a proven guy that certainly knows his way around this time of year.
I think that he often very subtly coaches his team through the media, more subtly maybe than last night. For example, when he had that exchange with a writer about Simmons' foul shooting, and he was definitely defending Simmons, but also kind of massaging his psyche a little bit, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. At the same time, in game two, he did have him out of the game for a sizable stretch in the fourth quarter, which was one of the things that was suggested about the whole Hack-a-Ben deal. So, you know, yeah, that's a little savvy too, I think, on his part to subtly do that.
Yeah, I like Doc. He's definitely a plus for them, no doubt.
Yeah, so I'm really curious to see where this goes from here, because of the four semifinal series, Phoenix is already in the clubhouse having swept Denver, but the other three are all 2-2. In fact, Milwaukee and the Clips both came back from 0-2 to tie their series. So and as we sit here, it's a Tuesday, and the Nets and the Bucks are going to play game five tonight, and James Harden is going to try to play. He has a hamstring. Kyrie Irving got knocked out of the previous game with an ankle, and injuries have very much defined these playoffs. I mean, also, as we've seen with Embiid and his knee problem, and we have Trae Young with a huge ice bag on his shoulder, Anthony Davis missing time, Mike Conley's out, on and on it goes. So I'm guessing this is the product, more than anything else, of basically playing one season on top of the previous one due to the pandemic. Does this ruin it for you, or do you just look at it as this is just how things are?
No, I mean, it's number one, I think you're right. I mean, the human body isn't equipped to play two seasons back to back, and that's why, you know, when guys, you know, I think the days of NBA players playing in the Olympics, I just wonder how many guys are going to continue to want to do that,
right?
But the other thing, I think it also goes back to Doc's level of frustration, because he realizes that, listen, I think most people look at this series and think the Sixers are still going to win it,
yeah,
but he understands what a missed opportunity that was, not just to win a game, but to ideally get out of this series more quickly and have more time to heal up going into that next series. So if they were able to close out at home, if they were able to close out at home Wednesday, and then you're hoping as the fan, then I'm hoping Milwaukee Nets go seven.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't wish for anybody to get hurt. I never, ever do that. But you can't wish for them to get tired and worn down and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the opportunity. So that's where I think, when you talk about his level of frustration, I think that's where a lot of it was coming from.
It had to be. Had to be some of that. Because, yeah, you're right. Yeah. I mean, I fully expected them to win last night and to just close the door on these guys this week. But now I'm wondering if it doesn't go seven.
Right. And that's – so even if they win – on Wednesday, which you expect they'll win Wednesday. Maybe I'm wrong. But yeah, I mean, is anybody going to be confident that they're going to be able to get it done in Atlanta? So who knows? But that's what makes it so much fun.
Yeah,
you know?
Agreed.
It would have been great to have a sweep, but it is going to be fun watching competitive games. And I give the Hawks a lot of credit, because I think they are I think they're outmatched man for man talent-wise. But I think Nate McMillan's doing a great job coaching. I really do. And I think Trae Young, all respect for him, because he's been a tremendous player. And even when he's struggling, he's still doing things to get other guys open and piling up those assists.
Yeah.
I know. I agree. I don't think they're overall that good, but they have a formula, and they're doing a nice job in the postseason. I'm impressed with what they've done. Yeah.
Yeah, he's an interesting player. I mean, there's a little bit of Iverson to him, I think, except he's a better passer and a more willing passer for sure. But he's a tough little guy, and he keeps coming at you even when things aren't going his way, and even when he's a little bit nicked up. So I kind of like that about him. He just seems like he's got, you know, a pretty big heart, because this is really the first time I've seen him for any extended stretch, and I just really I think a lot of him. And think about that trade, Luka for Trae Young, and both teams kind of won on draft day the other year. That's not bad.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, one other thing I would say about Trae Young, and I give Dave Jones credit for this one. You know, he was suggesting that the Sixers play Maxey more to make Trae Young work defensively to tire him out. Because if you look at him out there, he's not really working all that hard defensively.
No.
I think Maxey's kind of one guy. Moves at his speed, who could make him work a little bit harder. And one last thing on the guard front, Well, I was really happy when he signed George Hill, but he still doesn't look like he's anywhere near where, you know, he kind of needs to be an impact player in these playoffs.
Yeah, he really hasn't helped them much. And it doesn't seem like there's really a consistent role. That seems to be there's – I mean, how is that rotation work with him? I'm not really quite clear about how that's panning out, really.
Well, I think it's a little bit like a baseball manager rummaging through his bullpen to find somebody. I mean, they have like five perimeter guys, and he just kind of goes on a nightly basis to see who can give him something. I think a lot of times that's been okay. The Shake Milton example is a good one, but I mean, Thibault at times has been good. Korkmaz at times has been good. Maxi at times. Yeah. Has been good. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not a rotation, that's for sure.
No, it is an interesting, and all of them bring a little something different to the table. I think that's part of it. I mean, Matisse Thybulle this week was named second team all defense, even though he averages 20 minutes a game, which is really, somebody who crunches the numbers said that was the fewest minutes for anybody ever making an all-defensive team. I guess Bobby Jones once made it with a little over 20, but Matisse making it, and it's very well-deserved. He's just such a disruptive guy. I wonder, two things. A, will he be able to develop his shot where he becomes a guy like Danny Green, you know, the quintessential 3-and-D guy? And B, can he sustain that sort of defensive energy over the course of, like, say, 35 minutes? I think that would be hard to do.
I think he's that rare guy where playing defense interests him more than playing offense.
Mm-hmm.
I get that. It reminds me of Gary Maddox with the Philly.
Yeah.
You know, he was this phenomenal Gold Glove center fielder who would basically go up to the plate four times a night and swing at everything. And he was a decent hitter despite all that, but he really was out there to play defense. And that seems like, I mean, this guy's really, he almost has an intellectual approach to defense too, in addition to being really physically gifted for it. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, he's a very interesting player.
The basketball gods owed the Sixers a prospect from Washington who was worth a darn after the previous guy they took.
There you go. Yeah.
I have a friend who's a Washington grad, and I haven't let him live that down.
Yeah, I'm willing to blame your friend. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, the basketball guy, that is true. Well, he has an interesting background. I mean, he grew up in Washington State, but then he spent a lot of time as a young man in Australia, where he was a swimmer, which is kind of an interesting background for an NBA player. And then he came back and one of his first high school games was against Zach LaVine, which is...
Wow. Gordy's dropping the trivia. Yeah. The Seibel trivia.
So,
I don't cover the team, but it's from afar, it sure seems like he's a great teammate, too, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's
yeah,
a great...
I mean, always with the positive attitude. Yes. I mean, you know, I think he's a great energy guy for them and a great positive, you know, not just physically, but that kind of emotional energy. I mean, what he brings, I just hope that he doesn't end up being involved in some sort of package. I would make him untouchable, you know, whatever they do, you know, moving forward in the offseason, you know, because I think we know that his GM or whatever he's called is, you know, likes to make moves.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that they're better because of, you know, not only his obvious abilities and also the fact that he's got, I think, a considerable upside. But, yeah, because of what you said. I mean, you've played on teams and you know what guys like that have. The value goes way beyond the numbers. And I think you're absolutely right on the money with that. He's just one of those really bright, really energetic guys. I don't know if you guys ever saw any of the videos that he produced, the vlog that he produced from the bubble, but I think that says a lot about what he's about and just the kind of guy he is. Really an interesting, I think Pete Carril called guys like that light bulbs. They just kind of light up the whole gym. And I definitely agree with that. He's one of those kind of guys for sure.
And I am certain that he has been mentioned by other teams in trade talks already.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, no doubt.
I'm sure of that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And you've heard his names in those discussions. And, you know, the Twitterati, of course, are always eager to trade. Oh, let's trade him for, you know, Jokic or something, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do that deal when I'm in.
So I guess we should switch gears to Mark's day job. I'm sorry you have to take off your fan hat now, but so Mark, you've been covering Penn State for 33 years for various outlets, and I just wonder if you could just address how much coverage of the team has changed. Now, from my position, I've always thought that you were a little bit ahead of the curve as far as just understanding where the whole media thing was heading with, you know, as we spoke before about video and photography and the whole website of it. So I just wonder how this evolution has looked from where you sit.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, Gordy, I started off basically doing magazine coverage for a weekly magazine covering Penn State football during the season and then every other week in the off season. To now on that line's 247, and it literally is 247, you know, 24/7 kind of coverage. You never know what's going to come up. But the cool thing was, when I was back at Blue White Illustrated, they became part of the Rivals Network, and I got a feel for where online things were going. Mm-hmm. So when I left there and started Fight On State, which is part of the Scout Network, then the magazine was sort of an add-on to what you were doing online.
Right.
The important stuff was doing things online. Yeah. And that's where I realized the importance of things like video, audio initially, just instant coverage, stuff directly after games, stuff during games, stuff before games. Neil Rudell, I remember him, you know, hassling me when I would be posting stuff on the weather before the game. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, and if I wasn't at a game, if somebody else was covering for us, I'd call them, or I don't even know if we were texting at that point or what, and say, hey, what's the weather like? Because our people on the site want to know for an away game.
Right.
And he still to this day kids me about it, but it definitely has changed. And I have to say that I've been very fortunate that being involved with the online sites, being ahead of the curve a little bit, you know, I know good people like you, Gordy, who were in tough spots with daily newspapers. I, luckily, knock on wood, have been able to maintain doing what I do and having fun doing it.
Right.
And I'm very appreciative of the networks that I've worked for and being able to do it and finding a niche, doing niche coverage, and not being able to kind of sustain what I do, because I know that there are a lot of very, very talented people out there at all different levels, you know, from small town newspapers to, you know, Sports Illustrated and beyond, who have found themselves in difficult situations. Going through the pandemic, being able to have an online site, it was good for us. We didn't want the pandemic.
Right.
But we were able to still do what we do, and fans were still able to follow their teams. You know, while they were locked in their houses or unable to get out and about, they were still able to follow their teams. And I give Penn State a lot of credit because they still did their best to make players and coaches available throughout the year that we still had stuff to cover. So it's definitely been an adventure.
Right.
Things have definitely changed my job now where I used to show up with a pen and a notebook. As you know, Gordy, and Mike, you probably know too, you know, now I show up with a video camera, a still camera, you know, you name it, binoculars, two computers, you know, all this different stuff. But always the short. The shorts have been a constant. There you go. And the other thing that's been the constant is that press box. It's not really changed.
Yeah.
Outside of that laminate piece that was coming off where Gordy sat was there for like 5 years coming off. But the press box has remained essentially the same. You know, all the crap I have to carry into it has changed significantly.
So
one of the things that I loved about the Paterno movie was that depiction of the press box in Beaver Stadium in that movie. Because it looked like a sports bar.
Oh, my God.
Like a sort of industrial chic sports bar. Like, good Lord. What are you? Anybody who has ever been in that press box had to get a laugh out of that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that is by far the worst press box in the Big Ten. Like, by far. Yeah. And I know people don't really, you know, I know people don't care about our working conditions, but the staff is good, and they, you know, they get good information to you. So I'm not complaining about them. But that building, you know, Scott Radisek, when he's designing the new Beaver Stadium, I'll be anxious to see which phase the press box is in. I can just kind of
the
picture
very last.
This palatial Beaver Stadium in like 2038, and it still has that old press box. That's going to be the very last thing that they do.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt.
It's not high on the list. We'll always remember that. Was it the Maryland game a couple years ago when the pipes froze in the press box?
Yeah.
And there was no functioning toilet.
Oh, my God.
Had to go downstairs to go to the potty. I thought that was going to be a bigger deal for me than it was. I got through it.
Oh, my God.
That's funny. I didn't know that. But Mark, what's the most satisfying part of your job, and what's the most frustrating part of your job?
I think the most satisfying part, wow, that's like a deep question.
I'm here for you.
Just being able to communicate. We have message boards and stuff. I want to figure out the best way to put this. Being able to get instant feedback, I guess that would be the best way to put it. So we can put up a story, and back when you did a magazine, and you have to wait like 2 weeks to get a letter to the editor. Well, now I can post a story, and somebody will immediately say, Brennan, you have a typo in the third paragraph. Or somebody will say, hey, this is a really good story. Or somebody will say, oh, that story's terrible. You don't know what you're talking about. So it's cool. We have there's a sense of community that people are on our forums, and they're very – I think they're pretty well moderated. You know, they're not perfectly moderated, and you could have some hotheads, and you have all different kinds of personalities. You know, when I speak to classes, I say these message boards for younger people who don't understand. Older people like us would understand. They're like the corner bars of our old neighborhoods,
right,
where people would go and have the opportunity to talk about whatever. And you'll have the loudmouth in one part. You'll have the person who never says anything sitting somewhere else. You have a different conversation going on here. So it's a way for Penn State fans to kind of get together. But having that instant the feedback very quickly, it is cool. To be able to post stuff during games and have people appreciate that. You know, to do something as stupid as – or not, it's not stupid, but that may seem as trivial as – posting a picture of the goalpost so people know which way the wind's blowing for the game, or if it's like a strong wind, or posting something, a quick video of the drum major doing a flip for everybody who can't be there.
Right.
You know, these little things make people feel as if they're part of it. So to me, that would be the one of the cooler things about it. And I think one of the more difficult things is the lack of more long form type journalism. It's very hard to monetize that anymore. And so I would be better off doing multiple pieces of content or spreading out pieces of content that are more easily digestible for people, you know, quickly, than doing the long columns or the long feature stories that we used to do for the magazines, Cordy.
Right.
So not being able to do that, but you have to adjust with the times.
Sure.
So, you know, overall, I think I'm in a good spot, but I just don't have the opportunity to do that sort of thing just because there isn't the, I know there are different sites out there. Some of them specialize in more long form journalism. And there, I guess there's a market for it, but that's not our niche per se. That's not kind of what we do. We will do it at times. I mean, Sean Fitz will do huge recruiting pieces, but going and doing the old sort of magazine pieces that we used to do, you just don't, you know, it's not as wanted anymore, for lack of a better way of putting it, which is why there aren't as many magazines as there used to be.
I know. Yeah, it's kind of sad to go to the supermarket and like you don't even see a magazine section anymore. It's usually just a, you know, a couple things up by the register. So it's like, so, but you know, along those lines, a few years back, I did a story about Ryan Bates when you were still doing those sorts of things. And I remember one of the things that really amazed me about it was you had like that sequential those sequential photos of Ryan Bates running alongside Saquon Barkley. And I'm always amazed at the shots you can get sitting from the press box. That always amazes me how well they come out and really how significant they can be.
Well, it's proof that any dummy can take a photo. I'm joking around because we have good friends who are outstanding photographers and people who have really helped my daughter with photography.
I was going to say, yeah, she's very good.
But for me to be up in the press box, and it's really a lot of it is technology. So just being able to follow a play, and for people who haven't seen it, we call it the frame game. Mm-hmm. And what I figured out, I forget how many years ago, I mean, this is, it's over 10 years. I remember doing it with Jordan Norwood. I figured out that I was watching most plays through my binoculars anyway.
Right.
So why not look through a telephoto lens and just snap away still photos?
Right.
And you can really see the plays kind of broken down differently than you do in a lot of different spots. But it's fun to do. I know it's annoying to people who sit next to me in the press box.
I was more kind of amazed just about what the quality of what you're getting, because I'm like, the first when you first did it, I was like, what is he doing? How could he get anything of any significance? And then the product, you know, they all spoke for themselves, you know?
Right. Well, and that's where, in all seriousness, that's where the technology really helps. Mm-hmm. So to be a Joe Hermit or Harvey Levine or any of the people who Barry Rieger, all the, you know, Steve Manuel, who's done stuff for us, to be able to go down there and take photos during a game and adjust everything on your camera and deal with the weather, that is a highly skilled thing.
Yeah, it is.
To do what I do up in the press box, literally any dummy can do it. Seriously. I mean, all you need is a camera that goes fast enough and point it at the action. It auto-focuses and you hold a button down. And I know some other people have actually started doing it. I just don't know that anybody's as committed to doing it as much as I've done it. But it's really, it isn't. The one thing you have to have an eye for is the movement of the ball.
Right.
Some of the people who impress me the most in the sports coverage world are the cameramen who shoot golf.
Right.
The TV guys. Yeah. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine. You know, so for me, I could kind of track the football down on the field from the press box. It's really not that difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
But for those guys to track a golf ball and like zoom in on it, fair. And then, you know, pan out and then you see it like landing on the green.
Yeah, that's
a real skill. But it's fun to do. And if people haven't seen it, just look up Mark Brennan frame game and some interesting stuff will pop up.
Yeah, it always amazes me. I give you a lot of credit for that, because it's like I've never seen anybody do that before.
The other thing that, I mean, I don't know if you remember this, Gordy, but it was, and I say this when I speak to classes as well, that now you have to make yourself as well-rounded as possible.
Yeah,
that's fair. One of the ways I made myself well-rounded was by shooting video. Well, why did I start shooting video of press conferences and post-game press conferences? When my daughter was born in 2002, we got a little video camera for the event, for putting the crib together and then up at the hospital and then coming home and all that stuff. And, you know, sooner or later you get sick of shooting your kid. And it's like, well, what else could I shoot? So I started showing up at the media day and post game press conferences with my little video camera.
Right.
And people looked at me like I was nuts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other reporters like laughed at me for doing video.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, people thought it was crazy. But now,
everybody,
what do you
it.
See? You go to a post game press conference and people have their phones out, and
everybody,
you know, that was it. That's one of the other things that has been very popular, you know, knock on wood, that I've been fortunate enough to do before the pandemic hit, are the Brennan cams after games, where I could take people down onto the field and out into the middle of the celebration with no editing. So as I'm getting jostled, the people who are looking at it are getting jostled. You know, you're hearing what the players are saying to each other. You're hearing what maybe the coaches have a quick word.
Right.
Go back into the tunnel, the players coming through the tunnel. These are all things that I realized, you know, people probably would enjoy seeing this. And I specifically don't edit them because I want them to look like what I was seeing.
Right.
Yeah. So they're not that I'm not sure what editing would really help other than shortening them. But that's another thing. Being able to do video has been fun. And it's, I think I was fortunate enough to be a little bit ahead of the curve because I got that video camera back when my daughter was born.
Isn't that funny? I had no idea. And now she's a very talented photographer herself. She shot a lot of sporting events, correct?
Well, she started, it's pretty funny, Gordy, because she started coming with me to do like photo shoots and stuff when, you know, Harvey or somebody else would be shooting for us. And I think one of the first pictures she took was of Mike Motti, of a cover photo. She didn't do the cover photo. She just had her own little camera and she took some photos, but she actually did half decent. She must've been 8 or 9 years old. And, yeah, so she just enjoyed doing it. So I started bringing her, you know, much like I think it's probably how Mike Sisak got going shooting photos back before he became a world famous, you know, reporter, doing stuff with his dad, or Elijah Hermit doing stuff with his dad. So she just started coming along and shooting Penn State football camps and shooting state high football games and, you know, slowly but surely she got a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better. Still has a ways to go. I don't want her to get a big head. But she's, it's been fun. It's been a way for us to spend time together.
That's nice.
And now it's also pretty cool because like all the Penn State football coaches know her because she's at like the camps and they walk by. So she gets a better reception from coaches and stuff than I do. Hey,
Grace,
how's it going?
What's he doing here? Call security.
We were shooting guys showing up for camp on Sunday.
Right.
And she was at the stadium. We can't go into the camps yet because they're closed to the public. And it's understandable. I don't want, you know, to be a thorn in the side during the closing. As this pandemic stuff is coming to an end media wise, you know, I'm not asking for anybody to rush anything for us. But we are able to shoot prospects going in and out of Beaver Stadium and then down by Lash Building. And so she's up at Beaver Stadium and I'm closer to Huluba Hall. And this golf cart comes flying at me. And it's Franklin. It's like, hey, Mark, I just your daughter's doing a great job up there at the stadium.
That's so funny. That's funny.
I think they realize that she works hard at it. And I think one of the things that I kind of taught her is that, you know, half the battle is showing up. You know, that's so we try, and especially, you know, I'm fortunate enough that the team I cover, you know, I can see the stadium from my house. It's a 5-minute drive.
Right.
So why would I not be at every single thing that I could possibly be at?
Right.
So the fact that I was able to instill that into her a little bit, that she knows, you know, we're the first people down at a bowl game when Penn State goes to a bowl. And when we show up at practice and everybody from the team sees that you're the first people they're shooting, I think you develop a little bit of a level of respect. You know, maybe they like, maybe they don't like what you write or what you shoot or whatever, but I think there's a level of respect that, hey, you know, these guys are there. So, and that's, you know, for our, you know, for Lions 247, we're fortunate enough that we have three people, you know, Sean Fitz, myself, and Tyler Donahue, who all live in the State College area. And to be able to do that in a niche operation like this is pretty big for us.
And you got Joe Paterno to tell you to clean out your ears.
He yelled at me twice. And Gordy, I don't know, were you there for the other one when he yelled at me for wearing shorts?
I was there for that one. Yeah, that was a home game. I'm pretty sure.
No, it was a Tuesday.
Oh, was it a Tuesday? I thought he said something else. I tend to believe that I was there, but whatever. Go ahead.
Well, there's a story to it. I mean, do we have a second? We got time. But this was the early to mid '90s. What year would Derek Bonner have played?
Like 91, 92, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I asked a question about Derek Bonner. Didn't play a particularly good game against somebody.
Miami.
At the Tuesday,
I think it was Miami.
I forget who it was, but at the Tuesday press conference, I showed for people who. Mike was joking about it earlier, but I'm kind of well known for wearing shorts to a lot of different things, which was kind of I was a trendsetter there too. Nobody used to wear shorts to everything, and now everybody wears shorts to everything, to the point where I'm going to start wearing long pants just because too many people are wearing shorts. But anyway, this was back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Derek Bonner didn't play well. I was younger then, and I think I was probably more aggressive in asking questions about college athletes struggling, and I probably didn't do it in the best way. You know, I look back at the way that I handled questions back then, and you thought you were being smart. And anyway, long story short, I was wearing shorts, and it was like November. Mm-hmm. And I asked him some sort of semi-tough question about Derek Bonner, and he says, why are you wearing shorts? Why don't you act like a professional and wear long pants? And everybody's like, what is going on here? You know?
I sort of remember
that. Joe-esque.
So he goes off on me, and there's a rest of the story.
Okay.
And it's whenever I've had a chance to speak to alumni groups, I like telling this part because I think it's pretty funny. But as you guys probably know, Joe used to do get-togethers with the media on Friday night for road games.
Right.
But he also did them for home games at the Nittany Lion Inn.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I started showing up. Jerry Keller was always at them. Rich Scarsella, I think Ray Perillo would have been at a lot of them. A lot of the people who came up the night before the game would show up to the Nittany Lion Inn for these get-togethers with Joe Paterno. And, you know, basically, I'll just call it what it was. Everybody's just eating stuff and drinking. I mean, that's it, and, you know, and talking. So after that Tuesday, I show up on Friday night at the Nittany Lion Inn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a nicer area where they do it. So I wore like a golf shirt and regular pants.
Mm-hmm.
So I get there and I'm like hanging out with Jerry Keller, and Joe walks in, and everyone's like, oh my God, what's going to happen? You know, he just went off on Brennan. Is he going to go off on him again? And the room gets quiet, and Joe says, you know, Brennan, you're a pretty good-looking kid when you got long pants on. And the whole room just erupts.
Well done. Funny. Well done by him. That's good. Well done.
So what that told me, and this was one thing that I appreciated about him, was that he knew that I was asking a tough question, and then he was zinging me back at the press conference.
Right.
But then when we got to an informal situation, it was like, okay, that's put to the side. We can joke about it now.
That's good.
And that's a part of Joe Paterno that I don't think a lot of people, especially a lot of media people, saw.
Right.
For people who showed up at the Friday night things, you know, you probably saw that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
But a lot of people.
Yeah, no question. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's one of the funny Joe Paterno stories
I have that
people seem to get a kick out. I'm usually better at telling it when I know I'm going to talk about it, but it just kind of dawned on me that you guys might appreciate that one.
I like that a lot. Mark, you're from Hazleton. What led you down the media path? What brought you to the profession?
I spent 2 years at the Hazleton campus and played basketball for Coach Tom Cassis.
Mm-hmm.
And the team was called the Condors at the time. They all the campuses have changed to the Lions since then, which I think is kind of weird because it's like the Lions playing the Lions in every single game. But I came up to the main campus, tried out for the team here.
Right.
Bruce Parkhill's first year, didn't make it. And I'm like, I had a liberal arts 2-year degree from the Hazleton campus. Well, then I'm like, okay, well, you know, I'm done playing basketball.
Mm-hmm.
I basically wanted to figure out a way that I could stay close to sports. And I always enjoyed, reading sports. I'm like George Costanza saying that. I know. Yeah, I love reading the paper. But, you know, in all seriousness, I was fortunate that when I was in Hazleton around that time, we had two really, really good writers at the sports writers at the Standard Speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And one was a guy named Rich Scarsella.
What?
No kidding. He actually covered games that I played in.
How about that?
It's incredible. And the other one that I think you might know of, Gordy, was Mike Miorelli.
Yeah.
And so you had two young, super talented writers. And he also had Ray Saul, who was a trip unto himself. Terrific guy. For people who don't know Ray, we could do a whole show talking about Ray Saul. Gordy, I think I gave you the best Ray Saul quote. He was an old timer.
Yes.
He's been around forever. And I think Gordy did his obituary for the Penn Stater, was it?
Yes, it was something like that. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, and you said, "Hey, Mark, do you have a quote of Ray Saul?" And I said, "Yeah. There are three areas, the three most read areas of the Standard speaker were the obituaries, the police log, and Ray's column."
Oh.
And you always preferred to be mentioned in Ray's column above the other two. But no, seriously, having Mike and Rich there at the Standard speaker, they each wrote one or two columns a week. You know, these were like local guys. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, you know, this is something. So, yeah, I mean, Rich had a big impact on me wanting to get into writing when I realized that my sports career really wasn't going to take off. So I wrote for the Collegians. It ended up working out well for me and, you know, ended up, it's a long story about how I ended up getting the Blue White, but yeah, ended up things working out well, knock on wood.
That's great. I didn't know all that, to be honest with you. I knew that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I didn't know. I thought Rich's first job was writing because he's right around my age. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Well, if you guys have ever been around, Rich always calls me Big Man. And there's a story behind that.
Go.
Because when I played basketball in high school, I'm 6'4" and, you know, well over, let's just say well over 200 at this point. And not necessarily in a good way, probably well over 220. But when I first started playing basketball in high school, I was 6'2" and like 170.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a center. I was a junior. We had a center who was a senior named Bill Lane, who was 6'4", 225. Ended up playing tight end at Temple.
Wow.
Going to Temple on a football scholarship. And he was actually there when Jerry was there, when Jerry Keller was there.
Holy shit.
So I guarded Bill Lane in practice every day. And they mockingly called me Big Man. So, you know, like in your hometown when they pick out your biggest flaw?
Yeah.
And they jokingly, so it's, oh, yeah, Big Man, get out there and try to guard this guy. So I basically get beat up in practice every day. So that nickname stuck.
Right.
Until I got to the Hazleton campus and I was much, you know, I was taller and had filled out. But they still called me Big Man, even though I was still not, you know, compared to actual college, you know, legitimate college basketball players, I was nothing close to being big. But yeah, so he calls me Big Man because that was my nickname at Hazleton. Mm-hmm. That I had because people were mocking me because I actually wasn't very big whatsoever.
That's funny.
The lavish details are what we like. Yeah.
So
I'm sure people are going to love hearing all this stuff.
Oh, I find it interesting. I knew none of this.
Yeah, that's kind of our thought. That's kind of our school of thought.
Yeah. Don't sell yourself short.
I don't give a damn what anybody else does.
Yeah. So you go to main campus and you tried out for the team. Who was playing for the team then?
I actually played. Wow, this is so in-depth that it's unbelievable. There was a guy who's by the name of Terry Graves from the Washington, D.C. area who was dating a young lady from Hazleton.
Okay.
And we were playing pickup ball in Hazleton. And he shows up at one of the local courts, like dressed in his Penn State practice uniform.
Okay.
It was unbelievable. So he's like a 6'8 guy. He was a good player, like better than anybody we had there. And so we end up playing, and I say, yeah, I'm coming up to the main campus. And he's like, well, you ought to try out. So that's why I ended up trying out, because he suggested it. But I think, you know, the guys who ended up being on the team and being really good were like Tom Hovass, Brian Allen, Ed Fogle, that group of players.
That's a good team.
Were very young at that point. Uh-huh. And they were, they ended up being, the team really struggled the first year that I was there. but there were some really good players. But it was funny because, you know, when I did make the team, like everybody, you think, boy, I don't know if I really got a fair opportunity. It's just natural. Everybody thinks, either you think you're really good, or your parents think you're really good, or somebody thinks you're really good.
Somebody.
But so like 10 years later, they're playing the Commonwealth campus. I forget what it used to be called, the CCAC. I don't know what it's called now, but it's the Commonwealth Campus League.
Right.
They're playing a championship game at Rec Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And Neil Rudell, Hazleton is playing Altoona, and Neil Rudell of the Altoona Mirror says, "Hey, Mark, can you go cover the game for us?" You know? And I'm like, "Yeah, sure, I'll go cover it for you." So I show up at Rec Hall. There's literally 15 people in Rec Hall because, you know, who's going to come watch a campus game? Seriously. And I'm sitting up in the stands, and as the game's winding down, Bruce Parkhill comes out. Now, this is the guy I tried out for, you know, however many years earlier. Right. It may not have been quite 10 years, but regardless, however many years earlier, I had tried out for Bruce Parkhill and didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
So he sits next to me, and we're just sitting there BSing and watching this Commonwealth campus game. And I said, "Bruce, I owe you an apology." He goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "You know, I played at the campus, and I had no idea that the basketball at the campus level was this bad. I thought I was good." He goes, "Yeah, you'd be surprised. Everybody thinks that the level you're playing at is like really good. I had no business. I should have never even been considered to make the team, the actual team at Penn State."
That's funny.
But I didn't realize how. And listen, for anybody out there who has the opportunity to play at a campus, do it. It's a blast. It's a lot of fun. But that's not something you're using as a stepping stone to any other level other than maybe Division III.
Right.
There you go. Wow. The Brennan story.
So the one I was curious, you know, is Grace going to follow you into this media thing? She's going to Penn State. What's her major going to be?
She's undecided as of yet, but so I'm not – I'm not going to kick out there publicly some of the things that she's thinking about because she might get mad at me. But no, I mean, she just finished up her first year.
Uh-huh.
So she's at the point now where, and it was a crazy first year. She didn't take a single in-person class.
Wow.
You know, it just really sucked for a lot of the students.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very thankful that she's healthy and made it through the whole thing and everything's okay. But looking forward to her having more of an actual student experience. And in all seriousness, in terms of deciding what she wants to do long term,
mm-hmm.
I think part of that figuring out process is when you're actually able to attend college normally, you know.
Right.
But in terms of being in the media, I don't think if she wants to do it, I'll support her. But I told her to try to figure out something where she could make a lot more money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Amen. Amen.
Nobody has more fun than we do. I wouldn't trade my job for anything.
Yeah, that's
what I do. I mean, it is a blast. But if I were to advise my own daughter, it'd be, I think you could find something where you could maybe make a little bit more money. Not that I'm complaining. But she, she's smart, and she'll figure out what
I'm sure.
Makes
I'm sure she will. I was just curious about that because I know she has a talent for it. I've seen some of the work she's done, and she definitely has an eye for it. So I was just curious about if she was going to go down that road as well. So Mark,
I'm sorry. I don't think that's if she does, I support her. But yeah. I'm not sure if that's what she's thinking at this point.
Right. So, Mark, we appreciate you telling us your life story.
It's not like you forced it on us, big guy.
I know.
I was just thinking, it's like, yeah, I could see people saying, this is really not that interesting. Why do they have this guy on? Could you go back and talk about the Sixers some more?
Well, it is kind of funny because we sat next to each other for like, I don't know, 5 years, and we've never had this conversation.
Well, that's because we were actually working.
Yeah, well, there's that. There is that.
and busting you-know-what.
Yeah.
Oh, about screen passes and taking panoramic photos and everything else.
That's true. Cool. Mark, no, seriously, thanks, and it was good speaking with you again, and we wish you the best. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
All right, be well.
Thanks, Mark.
Yep.
Yep.
So, Mike, it's always nice to visit with Mark Brennan, a guy we've known for a long time. And playing off that, you mentioned just about how, as of June 1st, Penn State is back into full-blown in-person recruiting mode. So, obviously, James Franklin, that has been a huge focal point, as it indeed must be. What are you hearing now about where they're heading with that?
Well, right now, the way this is right now, a lot of what I'm hearing is from following Lions 24/7, Mark's site. Not to give him a plug, but you know, it's full blown recruiting camps, in person contact, visits, official visits, all that stuff. For the first time in, I think, close to a year and a half.
Yeah.
Because of the pandemic.
Right.
So, and James Franklin, I know, felt like they fell off a little bit in recruiting over the last couple cycles.
Mm-hmm.
So they have really hit the ground running. And I'm really, I'm not there. I'm not, like, taking pictures of the prospects like Mark is. But I'm just following it on Twitter and wherever else you follow it. They are really aggressive. They are really getting after it, and it'll be interesting to see, because this 22 class looks pretty good for Penn State. It looks like they're back up in the national, for sure, top 10, maybe even top 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a critical time coming off of a 4-5 season.
Mm-hmm.
And coming off of really getting gut punched by the pandemic, they really need to get back up to speed. And it feels like they're certainly doing everything they can do to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. And as we sit here, we're less than 3 months away from the season opener, correct? So
that is correct, yeah. And I think it's the most significant season opener, certainly since I've been covering the team, which is, you know, going on 20 years now. They're at Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
It's a conference game. Mm-hmm. It's two teams that got smacked a little sideways, two really good programs that got smacked a little sideways by the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are going to go into that game feeling like it's a big, they really got to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And only one of them is going to get it. So I think it's a huge game.
And then you have the then you have the local angle on top of that with the two Rucci brothers.
Yeah, Nolan Rucci and his brother Hayden Rucci, both for Wisconsin. Now, Hayden has been getting on the field as a tight end, kind of a blocking tight end. He played quite a bit last year, it seemed to me. I think he played in every game, and I think he played a significant number of snaps in every game. And his brother, of course, is this 5-star offensive lineman, probably a tackle, 6'8", 300 pounds, one of the most highly recruited offensive linemen in the country in the last cycle, from Lititz, Pennsylvania, from Warwick High School. And obviously he's an exceptional talent, but it's pretty hard to play early at that position, and especially if you did not enroll early, which he has not.
Right.
So he was not up there in January, didn't get the benefit of spring football. So I don't know if he's going to play, but it's a very significant, I think, day in terms of that local family angle for us. And just in terms of, the ongoing progress of James Franklin's experiment there and his attempt to get up on that top shelf of that sport, which is not easy to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. My wife had both Rucci's as elementary school students. She taught both of them. And when she sees Nolan now, she says to me, well, how big is he going to be? And I said, he's probably going to be 350 by the time he plays. You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he will, because he's got that huge frame.
Right.
And he's got a lot of room to grow, even though he's already around 300.
Right.
Precise.
Good size. Mike, you wrote a column this week about the college football playoff and how the plan is to expand it to 12 teams. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about that. And, you know, apparently, if I'm reading you correctly, the plan is to implement it around the 2023 season. I think I read that in your piece.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the plan. Yeah.
I mean, 12 is an interesting number because you said in your piece that you weren't really a fan of 16. But 12, maybe you can wrap your mind around. Is that what your feeling is?
I would rather have 8 than 12.
Okay.
I think that one of the things that's, but I don't think it's awful. I mean, I know you're a columnist. You're supposed to have super hard take and come down really hard one
hot
way
take.
Or the other. And I would much rather they had gone to 8. Frankly, yeah. I think that would be. I think one of the things that college football has to work so hard to preserve is the significance of the regular season.
Yeah,
the significance of the week in, week out grind. Now, it is possible. It is possible, and we'll see how this plays out. We don't know. We'll see. But it is possible that this 12-team format could create. Like some games in November, say, might be more significant with this format than they would otherwise be because teams will be playing
to get in.
They'll be still alive for that playoff berth. But then you get into do we want to see 3 or 4 or 5 teams even from one conference be in that playoff, which I don't know if we want to do that. And I thought as Dave, our boy Dave wrote about this too, and one of the things he said was he thinks this was the SEC kind of signing off on this and saying, okay, we'll do this, but we're going to get more teams in.
We're
going to get 3-4 teams in, and, you know, that will happen. I would much prefer 8. Think about it like this, and I wrote this in the column, Penn State, under this format, Penn State would have made the playoffs 4 years in a row, including that year where they went 9-4 and lost to Kentucky in the Citrus Bowl. And Penn State, you know, Franklin kind of shook up his staff. He fired that wide receivers coach apparently like 15 minutes after the game was over. And he, you know, that was clearly Penn State was looking at that season as, hey, we got to change some things. This isn't good enough. We're not happy with where we are at the end of that season. And they would have made the playoff in that season. And to their credit, they did bounce back the next year and have a real good year, when they went to the Cotton Bowl. And, of course, Michael Parsons had such a great game, and they won the Cotton Bowl. That was an 11-win team. That team also would have been in the playoffs. But, you know, much prefer 8 to 12. That's just my opinion. For a lot of reasons.
It should definitely be more than 4. I mean, if you have power five conferences, you got to have all 5 champions in, right?
here's the interesting thing about it. There are five power five conferences,
right?
But there are only the 4 highest ranked conference champions. We'll get that first round bye, which I think is going to be a real advantage when you're coming off a conference championship game, which all of those teams will be doing. I think it'll be a real advantage to get that bye, and one of those Power 5 champions is not going to get it.
Yeah.
You know, the last couple of years it would have been the Pac-12 probably.
Yeah.
Their champion would not have gotten it. And the other thing is Notre Dame can't get it. They can't get the bye because they're not in the conference.
Interesting.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting in a way. But on the other hand, if Notre Dame takes care of business, they're going to be in it almost every year.
Yeah, I would think. I would think so.
If Notre Dame is just, they're at least going to be in it with a fighting chance. Every year. And the other thing that could happen is 4 highest ranked conference champions. So that's not limited to the Power 5. So that team that Central Florida had a couple years ago, maybe they would have got in as a, I mean, the rankings at the time didn't reflect it, but it's possible, you know what I mean? It's possible that one of those non-Power 5 teams could be one of the four highest-ranked conference champions and therefore get that bye.
Well, that's kind of interesting. I think it has some appeal.
So you could have two Power 5 conference champions in that instance that don't get the bye.
I don't dislike this. I mean, I guess the thing I don't like about it is just, you know, the wear and tear you inflict on X number of teams. But I mean, it's, you know, all in service of dollars. I mean, let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah, all in service of dollars. And hey, honestly, probably a lot of them need some dollars right now.
Well, that's a really good point too. So
yeah, and it's still a couple of years down the road, and. Here's the other thing that I think is a little overblown in that vein, though. There's been a lot of stories I've read that have said, well, you know, these teams could play 17 games a year.
Right.
Well, that's true, but the only way that can happen is if you're one of these teams that's in a conference championship game and doesn't get the bye and then gets to the national championship game.
Right.
That's the only way a team could do that. I think that's going to be pretty rare, given the current power structure of this sport. And it would be one team a year that does it. I think that's a little overblown. Mm-hmm. That's been a little overblown, the 17 games thing. But because there's no doubt that whoever is in the championship game will play 16.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be 16 games every year.
Yeah. So in other words, Alabama and Clemson will be playing that number every year.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the other thing. And maybe expansion will, this is one of the things that I've written before, maybe expansion will let a little bit of air into this. I think there is a legitimate danger right now in college football with this top shelf, the top level being so small.
Yes.
It's really arguably only three teams. You're getting to the point where it's possible that their recruiting advantage could sort of perpetuate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're an elite high school player and you're interested in playing for a national championship, there's only really three teams you can go for. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but I think it was headed in that direction a little bit. It was almost like in economics, like the 1% that keep getting richer and richer and richer. I think there was a little bit of danger of that happening in this sport, and expansion might, lessen that a little bit.
Yeah, that would be nice. Because before this, I never remember it being quite like this, where it was like this stratified. Can you?
Yeah, I agree. And you know, they've been doing this playoff for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 28 berths in the playoffs, right?
Right.
28.
Mm-hmm.
Of those 28, 20 have been Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, Oklahoma.
Yeah. So there you go.
20 of the 28. And it's amazing how many of the games have involved either Alabama or Clemson.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost ridiculous. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I think expansion is a way to maybe over the long haul address that a little bit in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
Although, again, I think 8 would have been better than 12.
Okay. Well, you are duly noted then, and and we'll see how it plays out in a couple years down the road, and how it impacts the sport.
It is a ways off yet. You got to bear that in mind too.
So, anyway, I think we'll end our journey right there, and we will talk to you again soon. I'm Gordy. That's Mike. We'll see you down the road.
See you later.